someone noted that there's a new translation of Aristotle in Amazon's top 100. This translation by Bartlett and Collins was reviewed in New York Times this past Sunday by Harry Jaffer, who I've had some difficulties with the past. I think he's about 92 years old. But he's a supporter of the views of Leo Strauss, and this translation is also by two followers of Strauss. I just thought I'd let you know that if you get that new translation, it's by followers of this particular rather controversial thinker. Now before I get into today's lecture, remember I mentioned the last time that someone had commented among the YouTube videos that I sound like Droopy Dog, the cartoon character. Well, I've got one better than that. I sent the Droopy Dog cartoon to my friend at University of Rome, Roberta Madugno, and you may have read her book on, she edited a volume of Murray Rothbard's papers, and she spoke at Austrian Scholars Conference this past March. But as I sent this to her, the Droopy Dog, and she said her little boy had shown the video to her little boy, who's about, I think he's about 5 years old, and she told him that I sound like Droopy Dog, and then also she wants to add that I look like Droopy Dog too, so just thought I'd mention that. Now you remember in last time's lecture, I was going through what I thought was one of the strongest points of Rand's ethics, that she mounts a very strong challenge to theories that define ethics as service to others. There, as she points out, that there are a lot of views that have very bad consequences in the 20th century, like Nazism, communism, but instead we have to sacrifice ourselves for the party or the race or something else, and that really ethics consists of duties to some collective body or to other people. So this is all these kinds of views she calls altruistic. She points out that altruism, in this sense, has had very bad effects. And in her contrasting kind of morality, which is one that says that the individual primary goal is the promotion of his own survival, even though that's the individual's primary goal, maybe I shouldn't say even though, as a consequence of that, everyone who, we have a society of people who have that as their goal, that each one is trying to secure his own survival, and does so in the proper fashion, what she considers the proper fashion, then people will be supporting one another because they'll benefit from each other's efforts to each person's trying to secure his own well-being and survival, but doing so they can achieve best by cooperating with others in the free market, not by antagonistic actions. People have a basic harmony of interest in her view. So if they have a free market, then even though people don't have helping others as the aim of what they're doing, the conscious aim, this is the result. You remember in Atlas Shrugged, where all the great creative achievements of people benefit others, and it's the government that's trying to interfere with this and promoting collectivist morality that's ostensibly aimed at helping others but really doesn't. So the individualist morality really results in everybody being better off. So I can say, I think she's made a real contribution in challenging theories that say the sum and substance of ethics is service to other people. And I think she's also on strong ground if she can show that doing certain things or following a certain course of conduct is essential to our survival. that's certainly a powerful motive. If I tell you, if you drink such and such a liquid that you're about to drink, you'll poison yourself, you'll die if you drink it, I've certainly given you a very strong reason not to take it. So I think she's certainly right that if she can show that certain types of conduct are essential to our survival, she's come up with something very important. But it doesn't fall from these two things, namely that she's right to say that ethics shouldn't be defined as service to others, it shouldn't be characterized as just our duties to others, and also that individual survival is extremely important for each person. It doesn't follow from this that Rand has given us the whole truth about ethics or that the particular details of her arguments are correct. Now, how, suppose we want to find out, as I hope we do, otherwise we wouldn't be in this class, how can we find out how much of the truth objectivist ethics give us? How can we assess the objectivist claims about ethics? Now, the obvious way is to go through the steps of Rand's argument. And here, that's what we'll be doing in this lecture. Remember, I'm following the pattern here in my lecture last week and one today that I did in the first two lectures. Remember, in the first two lectures on the metaphysics and epistemology, I gave the first lecture a general survey of Rand's metaphysics and epistemology. And then the second lecture, which was somewhat more difficult, I went through various objections and went through the view in more detail. So similarly, in the lecture today, I'm going to go through the ethics in a little more detail. As I'm warning you in advance, this would be a little tougher than the last lecture. And we're going to go into some more philosophical arguments that sometimes can be a bit tough, but I'll try to make it as easy as I can. Preserving without oversimplifying anything. And the most important critical assessment of Rand's argument, my view, the best thing ever written on Rand's ethics, is an article by Robert Nozick, who is a great Harvard philosopher, called On the Randian Argument. You can get this if you can get his book, Socratic Puzzle. It has the article in it. That was the first article I ever read by Nozick. When I read that, it really, I was really impressed with an outstanding thinker he was. So I think if you manage to get this article, I urge you to get it. You'll find it very, very useful. And Nozick's a very difficult writer in the sense, not that he has long sentences or words that are hard to follow, but he packs an enormous amount of arguments into each page and doesn't repeat things. He'll just say important things just one time, so you really have to follow extremely closely. Everything is organized in his mind when he's writing, but he just assumes everybody else is on his level and just follows the claims that he's making the way he does. And most people can't do it. You have to study what he does. Not very careful. So to say, one thing we can do, and we'll be doing this in much of the remaining part of the lecture, is to go through the steps of Rand's argument. Now, another thing we can do, I should have left out the, put either C or text. We should see, test objectivist conclusions against our moral judgments in particular cases. So, the idea here is that we know something about morality already, even before we start studying ethics. We know that certain things are wrong. An example, we've just seen there was a big case that was in the news a few days ago, the Casey Anthony case, which involved a woman who was accused of murdering her own baby. She was found not guilty. I think we can clearly see if she did do that, if someone murdered her own baby, that would be the wrong thing to do. This isn't a theoretical judgment. It isn't that we deduce that from some kind of theory of morality and say, well, since we're objectivists, we're utilitarians, we're conscious, we can deduce that killing your own baby is wrong, or killing any baby is wrong. We're just, this is something that we know already, so if it turned out some ethical theory that we're considering said it was all right to get rid of your own baby, we would know that theory isn't correct. We have this pre-theoretical knowledge about morality, and that's one way we can judge whether particular moral theories are correct. And I should say, objectivists wouldn't accept this method. They wouldn't say, well, we have certain views about morality, certain things we know, and then we can test whether objectivism is right by seeing if it comes up with the correct answers based on our previous knowledge of things. They would say, no, the system has to be built up just in the way they do. Remember, when we're going over the theory of concept, all the concepts have to be properly formed. Then if we get the correct theoretical conclusion, of course they think they do, then even if it turns out in some cases that objectivism doesn't come up with judgments that agree with what we would have said before, this is no reason to reject objectivism. Of course, objectivism doesn't say it's all right to kill babies, but in some cases, say, involving duties we have to others, it comes up with some conclusions that go against our common sense or pre-theoretical knowledge. But objectivists would say, even if that's right, that doesn't matter. They would reject it. Now, let me see if there's some. I don't want to get caught up too much in the question, I'll just tell. Charles says, well, is it, say, some cultures do kill the newborn for various reasons? Is it, they may be immoral by our standard, or are they by their own standard? Well, they might not be, but the idea of this view that I'm giving now is that we have the knowledge of morality is not just true for us, or just true for our culture, but we have certain knowledge that just is true in the full stop, that's all there is, and if other cultures violate these norms and they're wrong, that would be a view. Again, you don't have to accept that view, but we have this pre-theoretical knowledge about the world. It alluded to that, right, what we're saying is we're testing conclusions against intuition. I think this is going to be on my next slide, if I can remember my own slide. So, see, objectivists don't accept that. They say, no, we can't do that. So they say, this is wrong to try to come up with knowledge that isn't formed according to the way they have. So now we'll be getting to that, this method of testing objectivism by conclusion that comes up and see whether they agree with common sense a little later in the lecture. But now I want to go through some of the details of the Rand's argument and see whether we can raise objections to them, that we should accept them. And remember, one of the key points in the objectivist argument is that they say human beings don't have instinct. You can question that, at least. We don't have, even if you think human beings do have instinct, we're not dominated by instincts the way animals are. We need to use reason in order to survive. It isn't, say, supposing an animal doesn't need to think about what to do in order to survive, but we do. We don't just survive automatically. So then they go on from there, which I think is unquestionably right, that we need to use reason in order to survive. They say, therefore, the purpose of reason, what reason is for, is to help us survive. So we want to ask now, is this a good argument? Remember, the argument is we need to use reason in order to survive, therefore that's what reason is for. This is what reason is for, to help us survive. So Rand appears to be drawing an analogy from biology. She's saying, well, animals survive by instinct, but we don't rely on instincts, we have reason, so that's how we survive, and therefore that's the purpose of reason. But if she's drawing an analogy from biology, there's some views of biology that you could question what she says about biology. For example, Richard Dawkins, in things that called The Selfish Gene, and then later work, says that what's going on in evolution is that the genes are primary thing going on in evolution is the natural selection of various genes, various biological characteristics of us. And if that's the case, this can lead to individual sacrifice in some circumstances. For example, you share certain genes with your close relatives, say you have half the genes of your parents. So supposing you could sacrifice yourself for both, save the lives of both your parents, then maybe you have, it wouldn't be wrong to, that might be evolutionary. Say, let's change it down. You could sacrifice yourself for both your parents plus your brothers and sisters, you sacrifice yourself for your whole family. Maybe that would promote the survival of your genes more than preserving your own life would do. So if this view of evolution is right, then you can't say, well, we have to use reason in order to survive. The purpose of reason is to help us survive because we need to use reason in order to survive on evolutionary grounds. Because unlike animals, animals use instinct to survive. And so reason here substitutes for instinct, but here the argument is instinct isn't as primary purpose helping the individual survive, but helping the genes survive. So the analogy would be we need to use reason to help our genes survive rather than individual. Now Herbert made the point, I think I will get to that maybe in the discussion. I need to look at this in more detail. Now, you might say, maybe this is addressing what Herbert had, even if Dawkins is right about this thing, of course his views are controversial, why should this matter for ethics? Couldn't we say, who cares what the evolution has built into our genes, or what if you don't even believe in evolution at all? Why should we care about this? But the point here is that Rand can't unproblematically appeal to a biology point to support her argument. Remember, she said, look, what instincts are for is to help the individual survive, but we don't have instincts, we have reason instead, reason substitute for the instinct. But if it turns out that what instincts are doing in the animals isn't solely promoting the individual survival of the animal, then she can't just say, well, reason is substituting for the instinct, therefore the purpose of reason is to secure individual survival. But let's suppose that she is right. I'm sure she grants that premise, that supposition, that the purpose or function of reason is to enable each person to promote his or her survival. Does it follow that you ought to use your reason for this purpose? So remember, what we're saying now is we're assuming she's right. The function of reason is to promote your own survival. So does it follow that you ought to use reason for this purpose? Now, on Rand's theory of concept, remember how Rand says that we get concepts by the senses, perceive the similarities and differences in things, and then we get a concept through measurement and mission. So she gets the concept of ought from experience in a certain way. In the way she's derived the concept, it does follow that we ought to use our reason to promote our individual survival, because she thinks that ought, just it, in the way she's derived it, is an abstraction from animal behavior or instinct, reason substitute for instinct. So it wouldn't make sense in her account of ought to ask the question, ought we or should we to do what promotes our individual survival, because her definition of his ought is what promotes individual survival. So it wouldn't make sense to say, if ought means what promotes individual survival, it wouldn't make sense to say, ought I to act to promote my individual survival? I'd just be ignoring what, if I asked that question, I'd be ignoring the meaning of ought. So you see how the point goes. She's saying ought means what promotes individual survival. So then you can't raise the question, ought I to do what promotes individual survival? But how we know that this is correct, by left out the word is, we should have gone through these slides more carefully. It seems that she's giving a theory about the nature of ought terms, rather than an uncontroversial explanation of what the term means. After all, ought is a term in ordinary language. Ought, it's very hard to define in other words, but we ought to do something, it's our duty to do something, we should do it. We have all these expressions, we have a good, we know how to use these, we know what they mean in ordinary language, but what Rand has done is give some account of this. She has a theory of what ought involves, what things we ought to do. We ought to promote our individual survival, but she acts as if she's really giving the definition of the concept. So I think you'll find this very much in objectivist philosophy, that the objectivists will characterize or define certain terms their own way, and then if you question them, say, well, why do we have to accept this? They'll just refer to their own definition. But remember, ought is a term in ordinary language, so she's really giving a theory of ought, not really what the term means, at least. That's the way it's been seen. I see Herbert mentioned about the choice to live. This is something that's a very important point. We'll be getting that into that later in the lecture, choice to live as you're Herbert. You're right, that's extremely important objective ethics, and now I'm just talking about the meaning of ought. So, as I say, I think I've suggested that Rand is giving a particular theory about what ought means rather than just saying, really, it's defining the concept as she thinks she is. So it does make, if I'm right, it does make sense to say, ought we to do what will promote our survival? And suppose you ask yourself, ought we to do what will promote our survival? Doesn't this seem like an intelligible question, even if you think we should do that, if Rand is right about it, that's what we ought to do, but it's still intelligible to ask this, ought we to do what will promote our own survival? But if Rand were correct about this theory of concept, this question would be equivalent to, ought we to do what we ought to do? So it isn't, though. You see, if we say, ought we do what we ought to do, that would be a tautology, it wouldn't make sense to ask that. Of course, we should do what we should do, but we can intelligently ask, ought we to do what will promote our own survival? So the argument I've just given is a variation of an argument given, famous argument by Jean Moore, this great British philosopher, 20th century philosopher, and a famous open question argument where he said that the term good can't be defined because for any definition of good, you could say, is this thing good? Suppose he said, good is what promotes happiness. So you could say, is it good to promote happiness? He said that would be intelligible to ask that. So that shows that good doesn't just mean what promotes happiness. Now, I don't want to get the wrong idea about this open question argument. This, if it's right, I haven't argued that we shouldn't do what will promote our survival, we ought not to, or even that the theory that Rand has is wrong. All I'm saying now is it isn't, we can't say this is what ought means. This is just a particular view of ought. And I think this is a general characteristic of objectivism. You'll find they have a very interesting theories about various things, but I tend to think that this objectivist system doesn't have the compelling quality they attribute to it. They think they've strictly demonstrated that we must accept their system, whereas I view it more as a series of proposals rather than something we have to accept. Now let's ask, well, even if it doesn't, ought doesn't mean as Rand thought it did, what will promote our survival? We can still ask, is that theory true? Now, her view is that how you ought to use reason is determined by reason's function. Remember, she thinks, and we're accepting this because we're putting to one side this kind of criticism, the Richard Dawkins kind of criticism, that the biological function of reason is to promote our individual survival. Oh, now, Herbert has raised, I see another point I'll be dealing with later in the lecture. Sometimes objectivists don't think it's all right to sacrifice your life. That's a very important point, but I'm getting to that later. I have a certain order that I want to follow, so we'll get to your point later. Okay, so she thinks that the biological function of reason tells you how you ought to use reason. Since that's what reason is for, that's how you ought to use it. There's a very interesting book, it's originally a doctoral dissertation by Harry Binswanger, called Biological Basis of Teleological Concepts. This is, a very good thing to read if you have a chance to look at that. That gives a full account of what the objectivists mean by function. Now, again, suppose then, so we're accepting now that that's the function of reason, to help the individual survive. Then we have the question, though, is it wrong to use something in a way that's not determined by its function? Suppose you use your reason to help other people at the expense of helping yourself. Well, then you're using reason in a way that goes against its function, according to the objectivist view. But is that wrong? Well, we can come up with examples that where you're not using something according to its function. It doesn't appear that you're doing something morally wrong. For example, what is the purpose of my hand? Well, it's to grasp things. I need to grasp certain objects. That's why we have hands. If we're coming up with a biological explanation of how we develop hands, it would be able to grasp things. Like there's some argument causing purpose with reference to category of human action. Yes, this is an excellent point you're making, Dan. The objectivist view is that it's a more Aristotelian view, that we have the notion of a natural function, purpose of it, but it's not just based on human action, that's what you pointed out. So, in Thomas Aquinas gives an example. Suppose somebody's walking on your hand, or some people can do that, I certainly can't. Some people walk on their hand. They're not doing anything morally wrong by doing that, even though they're not using their hand in accord with it, in natural, with the function of it. And then we can come up with all sorts of other examples. Supposing you're out in the country, it's extremely hot, and you use the engine fan in your car engine as an air conditioner. That's not what it's for, but that's not its function. You're not doing anything morally wrong by using something not in accord with its function. So the later point is that not every use of something against its function is an abuse or misuse of it. We can say that we can imagine abusing something or using it in a way that destroys its function, but not every time everything we do that using something that's not in accord with its function counts as an abuse or misuse of it. Now, I've given some arguments that so far questioning the cogency of the objective inference. I said, well, first of all, we could question this biological argument, this analogy from biology, say that the function of reasons to help individual survival, just as instincts or the function of instincts is to help the individual survival of the animal. I said, well, on some views of biology, that's not the function of the instinct. So the analogy wouldn't go through. And then even if we accept that that's the function of reason, the function of reason is to promote individual survival, then we could still say, well, all right, even if that's the function of reason, it doesn't follow that we ought to do that. Why should we accept that? Now, Eric Mack, who's a philosopher at Tulane, very good philosopher, has objectivist sympathy, has an argument that strongly supports Rand on ought, and we won't go into that. So he said, suppose we reject objectivism. Remember, objectivism is the view that moral judgments aren't true or false. If I say, like, give an example I gave before, killing babies is wrong, all I'm doing, according to judges, is express a preference for not killing babies. I'm not making a true or false claim. Suppose I made the claim babies exist. Someone who denied that would be making a false claim. Someone said there aren't any babies would be making a false claim. I say babies exist. That's true, but if I say, according to objectivist, killing babies is wrong, I'm not saying anything that's either true or false. I'm just expressing negative feelings about killing babies. So suppose we don't accept subjectivism. Suppose we don't accept subjectivism. We think moral judgments are true or false. Then, according to Eric Mack, we have to show that moral judgments follow from facts about the world. And Rand's definition of ought achieves it, because what Rand is saying, it's a matter of fact what things we have to do to survive. These are factual judgments, just like other factual judgments. So it's not arbitrary, it's not just a matter of preference that say we need to have productive work in order to survive. This is something that true in a straightforward sense. So according to Mack, well, if we don't want to, if we reject ethical subjectivism, we need some view that ought statements follow from truth about the world. And we reject and quote Hume's view that we can't produce an ought from it. Mack is saying to get ethics that makes true and false judgment, we do need to produce ought from it, and Rand is giving us a way to do that. So we could raise some counters to Mack's argument. As we're going over a little bit what I've gone over already in the lecture, his point is that in order to be objective, and here objective means true or false, ought judgment can't be freestanding. So we say again that it's wrong to kill babies. We can't just take that and say, well, there's the statement, it's true. We have to derive this from factual judgment somewhere, otherwise we'll just have a preference. So another view counters Mack, goes against Mack, and says, no, this isn't right. We can directly grasp some ethical propositions as true. They're not deduced from anything else. This is, someone asked me earlier about intuitionism. This is an example called an intuitionist view. So I give an example here. I guess I'm, for some reason, fixated on examples of killing people. But we say it's wrong to kill people for fun. I think we accept that. If you don't, I certainly wouldn't want to be around you if you decide to have fun. So this position is called intuitionism. It's very counter to Rand's view, because it says we have direct moral knowledge of certain things that isn't derived from factual judgment, not that we're deducing certain ought judgments from fact judgments. This view is we just see that certain judgments are true. So one thing I should say about it, the term intuition here is somewhat misleading, because what was meant by intuition is an immediate judgment. We don't even have a hunch or a feeling. It isn't that I somehow feel in my gut that you shouldn't kill people. It's like on the intuition's view, something I directly grasp. So of course this view goes against Rand's theory of concept, because she says, well, we have to get all of the concepts by abstraction, the way we, according to her theory of concept, then we can get judgments if we have these properly foreign concepts. They're all inductions from experience. So according to her, we don't have this kind of immediate grasp of truth. She would say that's a Platonic theory. Sort of direct knowledge of truth. So this, I'm here not arguing for her, for this view, although I think there's some things in the form. I'm just giving you how this view, this intuitionist view, goes counter to Mack's argument. Remember, Mack, Eric Mack is saying, look, we need to derive ought from is in order to have objective moral judgment, and this intuition would say, no, you would say, no, we don't need to do that. Now, I want to now deal with a question that was raised by one of the people in the course, Neil Carrillo, who's extremely well informed on objectivism, because his own website about the subject. And he asked, I thought, an excellent question. Is objectivist ethics and natural law theory? We have all sorts of natural laws that support very important concepts in the medieval scholastic. People talk not that natural at all. So is objective aesthetics a type of natural law? At first sight, it appears that it is straightforwardly a natural law theory, because one account of a natural law theory is a theory that claims the requirements of human nature enable you to deduce ought from is. And this is just what objectivism appears to be saying, because it's saying it's a factual matter. We need to do certain things in order to survive. Therefore, we ought to do this. So we're deducing ought from is. And this is just like natural, or just one of the defining characteristics of natural law theory. It seems to pass the other requirement, which is where the law comes in. Well, the natural law theory has to give you laws of nature. It has to tell you fixed principles of what you and objectivism is doing. This also, remember, talking about principles, because we have principles of conduct, and not just, for example, judgment, deciding things on a case-by-case basis. We have principles that tell us what things do need to do in order to survive. I remember the last lecture, Maureen asked a question about principles versus pragmatism. So objectivism comes down inside of principles, plus it says we can derive ought from is, so then it appears that it qualifies as a natural law theory. However, in using philosophy, there's always a however but involved, very few things are straightforward. There's another side to this. There's an aspect of objectivist ethics that is not in accord with the usual natural law theory. Because in her view, everyone faces the choice of whether to live or die, or to die. This, she thinks, is a fundamental choice in ethics. There's someone who asked about this point earlier. This is certainly right. This is the basic choice we have, whether to live or die. So, but in standard natural law theory, what you ought to do isn't depending on your choosing something. You simply ought to do it. If you say it's a law, in Catholic natural law theory, it violates the law of nature if a woman has an abortion. So then the woman is not supposed to do it. The requirement she ought not have an abortion on this issue isn't dependent on her making some choice, even though it's the basic choice, the choice to live. It is just a binding requirement. So if you have a choice, if there's this fundamental choice, then it would seem that morality consists of hypothetical imperative. Hypothetical imperative is saying, if you want something, then you should do something else. Or if you choose to live, you should do such and such thing. So morality on this view, based on choice, consists of hypothetical imperative. So this seems in tension with the view that there are just certain things that we ought to do. So, because on one hand, objectively, we say what you ought to do is what will promote your survival. This is, seems like, and of course, what you ought to do is stating your duty, what you should do. It seems like that isn't dependent on choice, but at the same time, the objectively say, you have this fundamental choice whether to live or die. So among objectivist philosophers or sympathizers, the question of importance of choice has led to controversy. Now, there are some objectivists, for example, Tara Smith, who's a professor at the University of Texas in Austin, who has a couple of books on objectivist ethics. She has a book called Viable Values, a book to read. She stressed the importance of choice. She thinks if you took out this view that Rand has, that you have this fundamental choice or live or die, you just like people have these requirements, we ought to do this in order to live, but we don't have this fundamental choice, then we would have a version of intrinsicism remember, intrinsicism just that there's certain things that are good or bad or valuable or not valuable in themselves. The objectivist view is intrinsicism is wrong. It's only in relation to people that things are valuable or not valuable. Value is something we have to gain or keep. So if there weren't any people, there wouldn't be any value. But Tara Smith thinks that I'll read this. I see there's some people very actively chatting, but we'll read what they're saying till the discussion period. Okay, so she said, well, if you don't have this, you take out the part about the choice to live, then you'll have a version of intrinsicism. She definitely doesn't want to do that. But on the other hand, there are two philosophers who are sympathetic to it, Doug Racism and Doug Denial. They emphasize more the ought over the choice to live. So they say, no, there are just the certain things you ought to do, and they downplay this notion of fundamental choice. So there is that difference among objectivists sympathize. The Tara Smith view, the one that we have fundamental choice, is more in accord with the position the Ayn Rand Institute. Tara Smith is very closely tied to Leonard Peikoff, who ran heir to her estate. He's the self-proclaimed pope of objectivism. So that view stresses the individual choice to live or die, as opposed to this other view that's more accurate, just things we ought to do, regardless of what we choose. Now, one way we can lessen the difference between these two positions is to say that morality does consist of hypothetical imperatives, so that everyone or nearly everyone does choose to live. As I mentioned before, you need to do things in order, certain things in order to survive. That certainly gives multiple things, it gives a very strong motive for doing those. So in Constance, of course, mentioning Kant is rather incongruous and, of course, favorably, rather incongruous, of course, on Ayn Rand, but you need to turn. He calls this an assertoric imperative. Assertoric imperative is a kind of hypothetical imperative, that if you want to do this, you should do that. It's a hypothetical imperative. But everybody, it works out that everybody and really everybody will accept the antithesis that if you want to survive, you should do such and such. Everyone will accept that they do want to survive, so therefore the consequence of things that you have to do in order to survive is then binding on you. In this position, the one I've just sketched out, is exactly the one that Ludwig von Mises adopts. So he says, well, you need to do certain things. He says, well, everybody wants to prosperity. We need to do certain things in order to prosper. Everybody wants to live and prosper. But in fact, everybody, almost everybody, does want that. So they actually do give a very strong imperative. Now, Rand, as I just mentioned, seems obviously correct that the choice to live is important to nearly everybody. If somebody just didn't want to live, this would be very odd. Now, someone I see is making the distinction between choosing to live and avoiding death. I think here, the very interesting distinction, I think Paul Smith is making, that by choosing to live, she has in mind certain definite things you're supposed to do, as she would think if people say they don't want to die but go on to action the way they're contradicting her theory of ethics, then they're not really choosing to live. So I think she is packing quite a bit into choosing to live. But she goes further than saying that choosing to live is the basic choice. She said, suppose you don't choose to live, then nothing else could matter to you. And I say, well, I don't really care whether I live or die. Then she said, nothing else could matter. And she gives the famous thought experiment, the immortal robotics example, supposed to illustrate this point that if you don't choose to live, nothing else could matter to you. Now, the immortal robot, in her example, does want to live, but nothing can destroy it. It's just so constructed that nothing can get rid of it. It's going to be there automatically. So she says, well, if you think about it, nothing can kill the robot, nothing can get rid of it, so then nothing else would matter to it. So if you think about this immortal robot experiment, you'll see nothing else matters. If you don't then choose to live, the robot can't choose to live because it's fixed, but it will live, so it doesn't have to, can't choose, it just fixes it. Whatever it does, it's going to live. So nothing else could matter to it. But this doesn't seem to be right. And suppose the robot could feel pain, wouldn't have an interest in not feeling pain. So it seems, at least on the surface, things could matter to the immortal robot, even if it's immortal. So if this is right, this gives us some reason to question Rand's claim, if you don't choose to live, nothing else could matter to you. Now, one objectivist response to this might have this by William Dwyer, who was a very good objectivist philosopher. And he says, well, pain is an evolutionary response to help animals survive. So pain wouldn't exist for an immortal robot because pain is developed in evolution to enable animals to survive. But my hypothesis is the immortal robot doesn't need to do things to help it survive. But here I raise a question. Supposing this evolutionary account of how pain got here in the actual world is correct, why should that determine the meaning of pain? Why can't we say, look, even if that how what the way pain develops on the earth, that doesn't show that we can't conceive of situations where people have pain in a different, haven't gone through that kind of evolutionary process. Again, here, Rand would say, no, the only legitimate use of pain is that we got it through this corrective concept. We've abstracted pain from the way we've actually found it in thinking about animals. We get our own behavior, we get the notion of pain. We can't just take a concept of pain and just apply it indiscriminately. But possibly if immortal robots have pain, we can't do that. If you don't accept this theory of concept, then you say, well, why not? Why can't you just imagine the robot would have pain? You don't have to derive pain in this way, the way she wants it. And I gave in a review I did it rather, characters in the acerbic review of Peikoff's book, I gave examples against this view that nothing could matter to you if you didn't choose to live. I said, according to the Christian view and other religions, they say when people die, they go either to heaven or hell, into intermediate states, or various things that happen to you. So wouldn't it matter to you whether you went to heaven or hell? Even though according to these religious doctrines, you're going to be around, the person's going, their soul is going to exist forever. You need your heaven or hell, doesn't matter to you. So there's no choice to live there, but certainly things could matter to you. So what the objectivist response here is that they don't think there is such a thing as heaven or hell. These concepts aren't properly formed, you don't get them by abstraction from the real world. But what I would say in this is, doesn't matter whether there is such a thing. That when we think about these examples, we can see that the objects recognition doesn't seem right. So here again, whether you accept the theory of concept is really fundamental. Now, we can raise here, I think, another point, which I think is a deeper challenge to the objective position. And this is one I'm relying here again on this article I mentioned before by Nozick called On the Random Argument. Suppose that Rand is right, that everything, or nearly everything, that anyone acts to gain or keep, that the objectivist view of value, values up Rand, gain or keep, has the necessary condition that one is alive. Both I want it, almost anything that I want to gain or keep, I couldn't do it if I weren't alive. You might be able to come up with odd examples like commit suicide, near the possible end of the answer that I have to be alive in order to commit suicide. But it seems like for anything that I want to gain or keep, I have to be alive. Correct? I have to be alive in order to gain or keep it. Now, does it follow from that point that I have to be alive in order to gain or keep something, that everything we can value depends on the choice to live? Well, of course, on the objectivist definition of value, it does follow because the value just is what one acts to gain or keep. But Nozick has this question, can't we value states or affairs that exist only after we die in the sense that we think these states or affairs will be a good thing? So as I say, well, I hope that after I'm gone, that people continue to support the free market and don't adopt the socialistic point of view. Doesn't it seem that I'm valuing that state of affairs, state of affairs that people accept the free market, even though it's not something I'm aiming to gain or keep if I'm not alive at the time? But still something I could value. So if this is right, Rand hasn't correctly characterized the full meaning of value, things value something that to gain or keep. I could value things with states or fears that I don't at to gain or keep. Now, of course, Rand, the objection would say, well, this is an example of intrinsicism, and saying there are certain things that are valuable, just states that are valuable. Just in themselves, but we could ask, well, what's wrong with that? Why should we reject intrinsicism? Now, I've raised so far certain difficulties with the way Rand argued for ethical conclusion, but I want to raise now an internal problem within the system, not a problem with how the argument we use to get to a conclusion, but the problem with the conclusions themselves, with the views themselves. I'll be dealing here with a point that someone raised in the chat on survival, doing things worthy of survival. Sometimes the purpose of ethics is said to be for each person is survival. Other times it's said to be his survival under certain conditions, for example, his survival as a rational being or someone who acts virtuously. And remember, I mentioned this in the last lecture, you're not allowed to be a parasite. You can't say, well, I'm just going to live at the expense of someone else who's supposed to work productively if you can do so. So these two goals, namely survival and survival under these conditions, acting rationally or acting virtuously, don't always agree, at least it seems they don't always agree. What if you can, in some cases, best secure your survival by not acting virtuously? Rand's response to this kind of objection is that it rests on a false premise. She said, in fact, acting virtuously will always best promote your survival, or always, I should say, step to so-called emergency situations, which we can put to one side for you. As an example, John Hospers, who's a philosopher, just died, I think, a couple of weeks ago at age 93. He imagined the case of a bank employee who embezzles money, just one, and he lives happily ever after on the proceeds. So she said, Hospers said, well, look, the bank employee is not actually virtuously stolen money, but much happier afterwards. So Rand said, no, this isn't right. She thinks he would always live in fear of being found out, so he wouldn't be happy. But why should we accept it? It appears that Rand had just written a story in line with her own views, but she hasn't really shown that you're always what best promote your survival, living in the way she said. I should say Kara Smith also got that position. Well, it just wouldn't work out that people could promote their survival best by not acting virtuously. Now, suppose you think Rand is right there, but Rand, even if you think that, Rand herself think there are cases where self-sacrifice is justified. For example, she thinks that someone else's life may count as so high a value for you that your life wouldn't be worth living without them. She said herself that she would stop a bullet for her husband, Frank O'Connor. She would give up her own life for the husband. I should say, someone said that the bank employee will always know he's a fraud, or therefore never be able to cheat to heaven. Yes, she does say that, but the question would be, why should we accept that? Why should we agree with her that thinking that he's a fraud will interfere with his pursuit of happiness? Why don't you just forget that, or if he takes a memory pill, some sort of pill that will wipe out his memory of what he did. But in this case, so Rand is saying, well, there's some cases where you can sacrifice yourself for other people. So here we certainly have a case where there's a conflict, in turn, a conflict to survival, just physical survival, survival under certain conditions. Here she says, well, you could sacrifice yourself if the value of what you're giving your life up for was high enough for you to sacrifice yourself. You couldn't really live your life without that person. So clearly, in this sort of case, you're not acting to cure physical survival. Now, note that you raise a related point here, kind of interesting criticism. He said, Is she really right when she says you couldn't live without another person? Well, supposing, imagine, say, I think it actually happened, the husband died, just natural causes. She didn't commit suicide after he died. So it isn't true then that she couldn't survive or live without him. But nevertheless, she thought she was willing to sacrifice her life for him. So her account of this type of case seems flawed because it isn't the case that she couldn't literally survive without. She probably feel very bad if he died, but most people, when people close to them die, they're very sad for a while, but they get over it eventually. So that even if you don't accept Nolan's objection, it's still the case that she thinks that there's justifiable case of sacrifice. So her reality isn't one always of saying that you should do whatever promotes your own survival. Now, but she said, though, she's not contradicting her opposition to altruism in saying that there are certain types of self-sacrifice that are justifiable. That's her principle. Don't sacrifice a higher value for a lesser value. So she could sacrifice herself for a husband, but you shouldn't sacrifice yourself for someone you regard as a less value than yourself, for example, a stranger or an enemy. Now, one problem I have here with this, that I'm raised that there you might want to consider, is Rand's principle that you shouldn't sacrifice the higher value for a lower value doesn't rule out as much as you might at first think. Let's take an extreme case of someone acting antithetically to objectivist ethics. Let's imagine a Nazi who believes he should sacrifice himself to carry out Hitler's will. Rand's principle would tell the Nazi not to sacrifice himself if he really didn't care about Hitler, but just thought it would be duty to do so. So he was trained in the Nazi party that, well, you have to give up your life if Hitler tells you to do it. And he just didn't want to bother with that. He said, why should I do that? Then, on objectivist principle, he shouldn't sacrifice life. But suppose he thought this person really did value Hitler. Of course, he shouldn't. But suppose he did, then his principle that you shouldn't sacrifice a higher value for a lower value wouldn't tell him, given the values he holds, that he shouldn't sacrifice his life. Now, the last point I want to raise is, here we return to something we discussed a little bit before, does objectivism come up with the correct answers according to our considered moral judgment? Remember, objectivists won't accept this kind of criticism. They say, you can't just have these freestanding judgments or intuitions about things. Everything has to be built up systematically from the theory of concept. So remember, objectivists think that we have no moral duty to help others. You can, if you want to help others, and Rand thinks that sympathy for others and desire to affirm life might lead us in many cases to act on others' behalf. I think as Neil points out in one of those forms, Rand thinks if you're in an emergency situation where you have to save your own life, you can save other people. You should do that because that expresses kind of a general valuing of life, and I'm sure Rand would think it's better to save a baby from drowning if you can do so while it's in danger to yourself. But she thinks this kind of thing isn't a major significance. It isn't that you're guilty of some kind of grave moral fault if you were to just pass by a drowning baby. It would be nice to do it to help the baby, but you're not really strictly required to do it. That she uses ought, or you ought to do them to promote your own survival. Now, the point that I'm making has to be distinguished from libertarian claims. We have no enforceable moral duty to help others. So if somebody just passed by the drowning baby, that wouldn't be actionable. We couldn't use force against it to make it do that, to punish him, to do something, to force him to save the baby. But it wouldn't follow from that point what duty should be enforced, but he wouldn't be doing something with morally wrong if he just passed by the drowning baby. So if we think that we do have these duties to others in a way that Rand theory rejects, then that would be a reason we might want to question whether she can hold truth and morality. The last thing I'll mention, Michael Humer, who's a very good philosopher, was one time sympathetic to Rand, but turned against him. He's criticized Rand in this way. She says, remember we discussed in the last lecture, that respecting the rights of others best advances self-interest. Remember, she thinks there's a basic harmony among people, that we don't advance our own interest by using preying on other people who are acting as parasites. But he said, well, what if it didn't advance our own interests to respect the rights of others. Then he thinks she would, as an ethical egoist, have to say that you should take advantage of others. I think she could successfully reply to this, that she isn't advancing egoism as a theory for situations like that, where people wouldn't be in situations where there's no harm in the injury. She's concerned that the actual world, remember on her theory, the actual world is the only possible world. So she, I think, the humorous criticism theory wouldn't work. So, okay, so we covered a lot in this lecture on the very difficult material. I think in the rest of the time, we can have questions and objections. I think there's quite a bit of people. The discussion is going on in the chat. Now, a question here we have, do you think Rand would agree with Dawkins' argument that God's illusion? Well, of course, Rand was an atheist, but I don't know that she would have particularly accepted the arguments that Dawkins gives on evolution, on how we develop the concept of God. And she would disagree with him strongly. I think his view is that he thinks it's very improbable that God is there. But he doesn't reject the concept that he can show as a sort of philosophical argument that God doesn't exist. Remember, I mentioned this in the first or second lecture. She does say she thinks the concept of God is incoherent, but she wouldn't agree with him on that. Okay, anyone else? Let's see, someone has an example. Do you think that Rand would agree with people on the Iraq-Afghanistan wars? Well, I'm going to mention war in lecture number 6. I'm not really sure she would, because in her own view, remember she was a non-interventionist on World War II, so I think Peacock is somewhat more bellicose in foreign policy than she was. Of course, it's difficult to determine. Now, as I said, is this psychological egoism? No, her view wasn't that psychological egoism would be something that is, we always ask in what we think is our own interest. So suppose we have a case say where, let's imagine Mahatma Gandhi would go on fast because he wanted to help cause Indian independence. So psychological egoists would say, well, he's doing that because that gives him the most satisfaction. So on psychological egoism, whatever you do, even things that could appear to be sacrificing yourself, you're really doing it to promote your own interests, your own satisfaction. So Rand didn't hold that. She thought there were ways that you could act that would be definitely against your interest. So an altruist is acting in a possible way, but not in a way that he should act. But now Herbert said, well, I don't think she thought that Hitler shouldn't be stopped. It's just a question, should the U.S. intervene in the war, or could war have been avoided? She didn't really write an enormous amount on that. I think she was at the time in this intervention. Let me see, someone else. Bill points out Rand got pretty bellicose later in life. Yes, I think especially in certain issues like in the Middle East, I think she was somewhat of an interventionist. You know, her views, she didn't really write in one thing out of that. Now, Lucas said, it isn't virtuous to pay taxes and support the state. That's to promote your survival. And I said, I think she would think even if not paying your taxes would have bad consequences for you, then you're justified in doing that. So it wouldn't be an appeal to have to go to prison just to because you thought that certain use of taxation was unjust. Danny points out that economic policy would eventually be down for without US involvement. Yeah, that's a very interesting point that if you have an interventionist socialist economy, it's not going to be able to survive. Someone recommends reading Buchanan's book on this civil war. If possible, you can ask whatever you like, but if possible, could we try to have more of the questions on what was in the lecture, if anyone's interested in what was in the lecture? Yeah, I know some of these war issues are very interesting to people, but that we need to get the philosophy, the object of philosophy, too. So, do we have any questions on the ethics or anything, any points like raised in the lecture? Can a participant review the slide right now? I guess as long as you know, I can on my screen. I don't know what you can see, but it's certainly all right with me. I don't know. Is there a particular slide you want me to comment on? Okay, Herbert doesn't like social security. Yes, I think that's a good point. Yes, I don't like social security either. Now, Jesse says, to what extent did Aristotle influence Rand's ethics? Well, there are certainly very strong parallels between what Rand said and what Aristotle said, but I don't think she developed her views by studying Aristotle a lot. She read a book on history of philosophy by B.A.G. Fuller. That one gave her most of what she knew about ethics, and she read Aristotle, I think she really developed her view somewhat independently. There's a strong parallel between Aristotle and Rand. Now, Charles has a question about particular slides that can't get back. Well, do you remember approximately what you wanted to ask? That's a problem to figure out what they were. The book on history of philosophy, B.A.G. Fuller, I don't remember the exact title. I'll just put down his name. People used to call him Bag Fuller. Oh yes, that's Wilhelm Windelbaum. Now he was one, it was funny she recommended that book because he was a neo-Kantian and she didn't like him. But I think she thought that book gave a very good account of a different systems of philosophy, a very good historian of philosophy. He also, von Mises thought highly of Windelbaum also. So I think he certainly one that's worth reading is one of the standard histories of philosophy. It isn't one that's too much read today by other than objectivists, but I think it certainly is one that you should would be definitely worth looking at. Used to be you could get it in paperback, I think it's type of book. I think published by Harper, but I don't know whether it's still available, but it's certainly worth looking there. Now, let me see, Chase said, what about Rand's belief that you can't achieve happiness unless you earned it? Well, here again, wants to know what the argument is based on. Here again, this is the general problem in the Aristotelian ethic. She's defining, characterizing happiness in a certain way. So, on her account of happiness, what she says is true because she's building into the concept of happiness that you have to, you can't be happy unless you are honest and virtuous and work productively. So somebody who was lazy or parasitical couldn't be happy. But there's another sense of happiness people use of happiness, I imagine, has a state of mind where you have pleasant feeling, somebody in a very, many people in a very good mood, people who are satisfied with the way they're living. You can contrast being happy with being depressed. So in that sense, it's not clear why you need to live in a particular way in order to be happy. It could just work out that people who are productive tend to be happier than others, but that would seem to be a principle you would just have to find out by investigation whether it's true. Now, she didn't accept it. She thought, well, look, these are not just, it isn't just a look and find in the world of productive people that tend to be happier than lazier ones. This is a necessary connection we investigate, we get concept of happiness comes when we cross abstraction by measurement of machine can properly apply this process, getting concept of happiness, it'll have this characteristic that productive work is one that defines the component. So again, as I've said many times, the theory of concept is primary. Yes, Herb is finding this is part of her definition of happiness. Remember, definitions for her are not arbitrary, it's derived from experience. It's very much a matter of do you accept her concept, the way to your concept. Lucas asked the question, how do objectivists avoid self-ownership as being a necessary condition for action? Well, I think they tend not to use the term self-ownership. I don't think they reject the principle that each person should be in control of the decisions and things of their life. They tend not to use that term, though. Someone said, at just a month, you know, how influential was Rose Wilder weighing on Rand's youth? Well, that's not a question I've really investigated. I don't think Rose Wilder Lane didn't do much in philosophy, so I don't think she influenced Rand's philosophy all that much. I think her portrayal of free market probably had quite a bit of influence on him, but I don't think philosophy did. Now, Leslie asked a very interesting question. Would a person who sincerely tried to be productive but was unsuccessful be happy or good? Well, I think she would probably say he was as happy or good as he could be. But, you know, as Aristotle pointed out, he thought that under certain conditions, someone couldn't be happy. Suppose a person just is living, let's imagine, say you're living in Stalinist Russia, you might not be able to be happy. So it could be that if the person really didn't have enough ability to do productive work, if he tried, he would fail to be good, not to his own fault, and just wouldn't do it, wouldn't fulfill the conditions. Now, Herbert disagrees with this, but this is not Herbert, I hear you're not being an Aristotelian, which is not necessarily to say you're wrong, but this is not Aristotle's point of view. I have to look up whether the Rand specifically addresses this point. If she's an Aristotelian, she disagreed. Now, Maureen says Rand's of libertarians or hippies are right. Is she referring to anarcho-capitalism with Peacock to hold the same view? Yes, she means anarcho-capitalism and other libertarians, and Peacock does have a hold the view. What she meant when she said hippies was she thought that libertarians favor the free market because they don't believe in objective morality. They think that they don't like the idea of government telling them what to do. They want to do whatever they want. Just the hippies want to take certain drugs when the government says you're not allowed to use those drugs. So she tends to think of libertarians as people who really just didn't have an objective ethics, not just objective, not believe in morality at all. People just said, well, we want to eliminate the government because the government's telling me what to do and I don't want this. I think there's a mischaracterization of libertarianism that was sort of newer than that. Danny wants to know what context did Rand first seriously study Aristotle and Thomas? Well, as she studied philosophy a little bit when she was in Russia, according to Steve Barra and Ayn Rand, the Russian radical, she was a student in high school of the famous philosopher Nicholas Lossi. She studied some philosophy then, but basically I think she really read a little bit when she was developing her own views, and she also, there were certain of her followers like Alan Gotthelf, who was a James Lennox, who was a very distinguished Aristotelian scholar, who I think Gotthelf talked to about Aristotle, and possibly to some extent. So I think she studied a little bit history of philosophy on her own, but she wasn't a particularly philosophical scholar, but she had some knowledge of it. She had a good intuitive, she seemed to be able to think her way into philosophical positions fairly well. Yes, I think that it's right that this is not that her view of libertarianism is based on mischaracterization, certainly of Rothbard, probably others also. Now, let me see. Lucas wants to know, do objectivists reject the fact that values are subjective? Well, they think that they're certainly could have a sense of subjective value in terms of what a particular individual acts to gain or keep, but she thinks that those values can be assessed as right or wrong depending on whether they advance people's interests in the survival in the proper way, her system says. So she's rejecting subjectivity, you see. Who would you say has more followers, say, Rand or Rothbard? Well, I guess that's a very good question, Dan. It depends what you mean by followers. I mean, I think probably many more people have read Rand and Rothbard than I think of people who really devoted partisans, I think would be much more closer. Well, Paul says there were hippies in the OLP, which is that it's one of the branch state libertarians, Oregon Libertarian Party. Well, I mean, I met people like that. It was pretty hedonistic. I met libertarians. I don't think it's a characterization, good characterization of a party lifestyle of each area. Okay, well, I guess we're about out of time. So I see there's another lecture starting in 30 minutes. Well, I'm glad it's not my lecture. So thanks very much. I hope we'll see you all next week. And thanks for your very good question. Thanks, everybody. Okay, thanks a lot.